All right.
If you speak the truth, have a foot in the stirrup.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 517. Let's see, what have I decided to call this one? I think we're going to call this one Egotastic Chat, with guest JP of Egotastic Funtime. Today is Tuesday, the 16th of January, 2018, and it's a cold day here in Bellows Falls, but well, hopefully it's warm where you are, or at least you're in a warm place in an otherwise cold environment. I know some of you are listening from Australia, where it is summertime, so good on you. Enjoy that. For those of you who do not subscribe to the Sea Realm Vault podcast, it's probably been a while since you've heard a full-length show from me. That's because it's been so cold, I haven't been going into the radio station, so I've just been uploading old episodes of the podcast to the radio station on Sunday morning, sharing old, or shall we say, classic Sea Realm material with the local terrestrial radio listening audience. But I do plan to get back into the radio station and record new material soon, so you'll get some Sea Realm radio episodes here on the Sea Realm RSS feed in the near future. As I like to do at the start of every Sea Realm podcast episode, I want to thank the generous sponsors who made this episode possible, and they include James S., who has a check sent every month, and also Excellus Capital Group. I don't know who Excellus Capital Group is. They sent no accompanying message, but they did send money. So thanks so much to the good people, or perhaps person, at Excellus Capital Group. And of course, thanks to everybody who subscribes to the Sea Realm Vault podcast. You are the folks who really make this podcasting lifestyle viable for me. And thanks to people who are supporting me on Patreon. I derive an added benefit when somebody supports me on Patreon because I'll go and look at the other creators that they are also supporting, and often I find very good stuff. All right, so I was talking to somebody the other day at work, somebody who is not as tuned into sci-fi geeky culture as I am, and I mentioned to him that I had recorded a conversation with somebody who does a YouTube show about the TV show, The Orville. He said, wait, so people will watch shows of people talking about other shows? Yeah, they sure do. In fact, you know, if you like a show like, say, well, I know this is a controversial one, but we'll say Star Trek Discovery. You know, it takes them a very, very long time to create all those sets and, you know, write all the scripts and create the costumes and do the special effects afterwards. That is all incredibly time consuming. And, you know, you can only rewatch the episode, well, personally, after a second viewing, I'm done. You know, maybe in a few years' time, if I'm reviewing something, I'll go back and I'll take in a sequence of episodes. Like, I recently, over a year ago now, but still, in the grand scheme of things, quite recently, went back and watched seasons 4 through 7 of Star Trek Voyager. And as I was doing so, Olga would catch me watching Star Trek, and she'd ask me how many times I'd watched that particular episode, and I might say, well, this is, I think, my third time watching it, but the first time in 10 years. For those of us who are really into our media, you know, we like to revisit it, but when revisiting it starts to wear thin, we like to hear people talk about it. So my guest in this week's show, his name is JP. He has a YouTube channel called Egotastic Funtime. I'll link to it in the show notes for this episode. And at the end of the episode, after you've heard JP and me talk, I hope that you enjoy the feeling that you got listening to this conversation, and you will want more. And it is to be found at JP's YouTube channel, Egotastic Funtime. All right, here's my conversation with JP.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
JP, welcome to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, hey, we're here to talk about fun stuff. In fact, you have not a TV show. To my way of thinking, it's just as good as a TV show because it comes to me via the same devices that bring me TV. But you do a YouTube show called Talking the Orville, and it is part of what I take to be a brand of yours, which is Egotastic Funtime. If I got the brand hierarchy right there?
That is exactly right. I have my channel, Egotastic Funtime, but I decided, hey, you know, I wanted to have, because I do treat my channel, that before I even started it, I was like, I want a TV channel. I want a TV show. I've always dreamed of being part of TV, and you know, now thanks to the internet, we can create our own television series if we want. So yes, Talking the Orville is a show on my channel, Egotastic Funtime, though it's set up exactly the same style of, you know, any video I would make on my channel.
And tell me about Egotastic Funtime, because I think it predates Talking the Orville.
Oh yeah, I've been doing Egotastic Funtime for a couple of years now. A very labor-intensive, non-successful channel on YouTube. You know, I was putting out multiple videos a week for the last couple of years. You know, I would gather a few fans here and there, and it's just, you know, the show is basically, the first few years was me just trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I wanted just to talk about stuff that I'm passionate about, but I also wanted to put on a little bit of a show, you know, do some comedy sketches, write jokes, try to be entertaining and not just be a vlogger. You know, put little effects and things like that in the show. And it's just me talking about nerd stuff or, you know, thoughts in my head for the day. But it wasn't until a few months ago when I started doing Talking the Orville that the channel really took off. And actually, the Orville, I have to thank the television show, the Orville, for helping me kind of figure out what even further what I wanted to do with Egotastic Funtime, which is just talk about, you know, TV shows that I like and movies that I like and video games that I like, and sometimes things that I hate.
Well, you are hitting it on all fronts, I have to say. I admire the just the full court coverage that you're doing on this. You have a day job, and you come home, and I know how much time video editing takes. Believe me, I know.
Oh, yeah.
So you come home, you've got a very nice technical setup going. You know, you've got some green screen and you key it very nicely. I've seen some very badly keyed green screen in my time.
I've made some very bad keyed green screens in my time.
Well, that was the advantage of you doing 2 years of trying to make the channel without really having the Orville to give you focus.
Correct.
Gave you time to get the technical stuff worked out.
That's exactly right. I don't have any training. I just learned everything by doing, and doing it often and over again with lots of failures.
See, I have the advantage of working with a TV station. I have a TV station that is like a 30-second walk from where I wake up in the morning.
So oh, nice.
I can go in there, and they've got nice cameras and nice equipment and green screens and knowledgeable people to help me. And still, you know, getting out a video a week, you know, when I hit that stride and I do it like 3 or 4 weeks in a row, I think I'm really, you know, hitting it.
Well, you are hitting it. It's very hard to do. I was doing, at one point, I was doing 5 episodes a week.
Ugh.
And it was killing me. But the thing was, is, you know, I'd always get into the technical side of editing, you know, the videos and adding, you know, cutting in scenes and putting in pictures and videos overlaid off to the side and things like that. Because editing is part of the, you know, I consider my channel a comedy channel, and editing is part of the comedy. You know, you got to cut it for timing so that the joke hits just right. And it just takes forever. And so I had to put aside a lot of my actual life. And I still do that in order to get content out, because I don't consider myself a YouTuber. YouTubers are people that make a living making YouTube videos. I don't make a living off of it. So I just consider myself a aspiring YouTuber.
Well, in addition to all the programming you create, you are also putting out a lot of merch, which I admire, because SeaRealm podcast listeners have been bugging me for years to put out some merchandise, and I just can't get around to it.
Well, that was a learning process. And actually, I have merch available, I've sold some merch, but it's gone down a little bit, and I haven't focused on it too much anymore, because I'm like, well, I need to make content. If I don't have content, there's no point in having merch.
Exactly. I mean, I've been doing the SeaRealm podcast since October of 2006. So this has been going for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And I put out some merchandise with Cafe Press early on. And, mm-hmm. You know, you can sell a shirt for $16 and you make $2.
Oh, so, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I've discovered it took a lot of trial and error going to different websites. One website that you do make good money with on the things that you sell is Teespring. teespring.com. This episode is not brought to you by Teespring, but teespring.com is a good one. You get a pretty good return. But the thing is people got to find your stuff. I did have, a few months ago, I had a t-shirt, you know, store up on Amazon.com because Amazon has this program called Merch where you can actually, you know, just like Teespring, you design a shirt and they sell it for you and make it for you and all that stuff. And I was making good money off of that. But then they're like, hey, you're, you know, this is Orville stuff. You shouldn't be selling it. So they canceled my store and now I don't have that income. So, it cut my income in half.
Really?
Yeah.
Your income total, your income from your...
From my content. I was making, you know, a little bit of money off of YouTube and a little bit of, and about the same amount of money on t-shirts. None of it, a lot of money, but it was nice to have a, you know, a little bit of extra money to pay bills with, but it cut it in half when Amazon took that away because I was doing very well, even with non-Orville stuff. I had non-Orville stuff that was selling. But because of the Orville stuff, and they're like, oh, that violates something. And I'm like, I don't see how, because I designed these images. They canceled the whole store.
Well, hey, that's a downer. That's a bummer. Let's talk about something fun. Let's talk about the Orville. When did you decide that you wanted to devote a show to the Orville?
Well, that's interesting. Actually, I did two Orville episodes. Because the whole thing with my channel is I never concentrated on one topic. Every show would be a different topic of whatever I wanted to talk about. And I watched The Orville when it first aired. And I was like, oh, this is great. Oh, it feels kind of like Star Trek. I love Star Trek. I want to tell people that The Orville is like Star Trek. And if you're a fan of Star Trek, you should check it out. And so I made that video. And it was a video called, this is late September. It was a video called Why The Orville is the New Star Trek. And that video took off. You know, for me, it was getting thousands of views, whereas usually my videos would get, you know, 100 views, 40 views, something like that. And I was getting thousands of views within days. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. I'm going to do another episode about the Orville. Oh, Patrick Stewart might make a cameo. I read in the news. Let's do an episode about that. That episode was even more popular. And then it came to me. I'm like, wait a minute. People like my Orville stuff and they don't like my other stuff as much. I'm going to keep doing Orville stuff and dedicate a whole show to the Orville. And so that's what I did.
Yeah. You know, I'm in that position where I'll put up a video and it might get 100 views in the first week. And I'm like, oh, come on. I put like 15 hours into this thing.
Exactly. That's what I was doing with all my, you know, for the last couple of years, I put in 15 hours into an episode and you know, to get 39 views. And I was like, oh.
But the videos that have, you know, found some audience were like sort of one-off, just dashed off things. Like I did a tiny house video. I just took a camera over to a friend who's got a tiny house and that got many thousands of views. And then I did two paired videos about antinatalism, which is the idea that you shouldn't have children, you know.
Mm-hmm,
and there's various reasons for holding that view. And one is that, you know, you want to reduce the amount of suffering in the world and life sucks. And, you know, if you bring kids into the world, they didn't have any say in the matter and they're going to suffer. So, you know, you shouldn't do that. So that is philanthropic, you know, loving people, philanthropic antinatalism. And then the next week I did another one. And that one's called Life Sucks. And then the next week I did another one called Human Suck, which is misanthropic natalism or antinatalism, which is saying that you shouldn't have kids because people are bad for the planet and people are just awful and you shouldn't make any more horrible people.
Mm-hmm.
And that second one has got twice the views and they've both done pretty well. But the second one, Human Suck, has gotten twice the views of the first one. And it's gotten so many comments, I don't read them anymore because people just weigh in and they basically say in their own words, I hate people. People suck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, down with people.
Well, you're offering an outlet for people, and that's why it's taken off a little bit. Because when you offer something, either you know you're either echoing what people feel, and you're giving them a topic that they can you know write in the comments and let loose a little bit. You're going to get more traction, and that's what it's almost like finding your niche, really. And that's something when I was studying YouTube, figuring out. You know, how do I do a YouTube channel and you watch all these videos about how to do YouTube channels. Everyone's saying you need to find a niche. And I didn't really understand what that meant until the Orville. When I kept doing Orville videos, I'm like, oh, that's my niche. Anytime I do something about the Orville, it's going to do a lot better than any other videos that I do, because that's the niche thing they were talking about. Maybe, have you started a channel called Human Suck? Because it might do well.
No, and I have no intention of doing so, because that's not a niche I want to fill.
Yeah, well, I understand that too. There's when I was trying to figure out what I wanted my channel to be, I was doing rant videos.
You're doing
which
what
still
videos?
Fun. Rant, where I'm ranting about something.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, I did, and they all did well. Okay, you know, for what I was doing at that point, you know, a few hundred views. But I'd rant about, I did one about how the public sucks, which is basically a people get in your way. If you want to do something, there's people there and they're in your way. It's keeping you from doing it. And I did one about just a myriad of topics. And they were fun. I still made them, you know, comedic in nature. But I decided, hey, you know what? I'd rather talk about stuff that I love than stuff that I hate.
Exactly.
So I went that route instead. Every once in a while, I'll talk about something that annoys me, but it's usually, you know, something kind of fun that annoys me, like, you know, the new Star Trek Discovery or something like that.
So, I don't know if you saw it, but I did a video called Klingons Have Beards. And in fact, the beard that I'm wearing right now started out as a protest beard, because when I first heard that there was going to be a new Star Trek series and that Brian Fuller was the showrunner, I was pumped. I was psyched. And then I heard that, you know, he had parted ways with the project, and I was like less psyched, but still psyched. And then I saw that first leaked video of the redesigned Klingons, or the first leaked photo.
The Remans?
Yeah.
Brown Remans?
The Sleestaks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And and then my enthusiasm went way, way down. And I, you know, as soon as those pictures started circulating, there were lots of people on YouTube saying, okay, these aren't necessarily the Klingons, or maybe these aren't the only Klingons. Maybe these are some offshoot, but we're still going to get, you know, the classic Klingons.
And yeah, I've heard all of those
Yeah, hope sprung eternal until that first episode aired. And then it was like, oh, okay, this is it. This is what we're getting.
Yeah, that's what you're getting. Yeah. I mean, I still have theories about that. It's probably not anything that other people haven't already figured out, but And I haven't seen your video about Klingons Have Beards, but I do believe that I have seen it listed somewhere. Like when I was scrolling through videos, I think I did see a title called that. Also, Klingons have hair on their head as well in most
cases.
Yes,
they do.
Except for an undiscovered country, but he still had, Christopher Plummer still had a little bit like a ducktail in the back of his head.
He did. He did. In fact, Christopher Plummer for Undiscovered Country basically laid down the law and said, you're not putting all that ridiculous stuff on my head. So he had very minimal prosthetics.
Yeah. Well, what was great, though, is that was great because it gave us, I mean, they should have went that route with this where, you know, it's a little bit of a minimalized Klingon, but still very Klingon. I mean, you know, he was more of an iconic Klingon because of, you know, all the less prosthetics that he was wearing.
You've probably seen it, but there was a video by Midnight's Edge about all of the behind-the-scenes stuff that lent itself to Star Trek Discovery being such a train wreck, and it mostly revolves around a CBS head honcho named Les Moonves, who knew absolutely nothing about Star Trek, couldn't tell Star Wars from Star Trek, didn't know that they were different things. And when he saw what Brian Fuller was creating for the show, he thought, oh, that looks old-fashioned. I want everything to be new and sexy and, you know, high-tech and redesigned.
And take place 10 years before the original series.
Yeah, exactly. So this was largely his train wreck.
Yeah. I mean, I'm fine with, you know, it's impossible to make things look, you know, as nostalgic as the 60s series, you know, looked nowadays, which is fine. I mean, you know, things are going to look better. Even if you try to make them look worse, they're going to look better. And so that's fine, but to be so drastically different.
Yeah.
A mere 10 years before, but I have my theories on that as well.
But, you know, Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine, they both incorporated imagery from that original series into episodes of new shows. And they went to great lengths to explain, you know, to present it as one continuity. Yes, styles changed over the decades. Technology advanced. The thing with the Klingon foreheads. Hey, we have an explanation for that. Hang on.
Oh, yeah.
This was Star Trek Enterprise that did that. And, you know, they made it one continuous 50-year-long, beautiful, shared universe. And then CBS comes along with this most recent thing and just scraps all of that, picks out little pieces, like from 70 years of continuity, you know, in the show, and bundles them all together. So basically the first half of season one ended like with the Star Trek Voyager premise. They've been teleported off to God knows where.
Yeah, I know they're lost. They don't know where they're at. Of course, there's the theory that they are in an alternate universe, like Lorca figured out how to, or somebody figured out how to, you know, go between different universes with, I guess, the spore drive or whatever. And so maybe they're, they don't know where they're at because they're in a different universe.
Well, if that's the case, and the first thing we see is a recognizably Klingon ship, you know, and we get the view screen on.
Yeah, you could.
Beards and hair. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, if they're able to explain all the slap in the face to continuity, they could do it with that way. My theory is that because of the spore drive, I don't know all the ins and outs of the series because I couldn't stand watching all of it. But the ins and outs
or
of
even
the spore
more
drive
than the first episode.
Yeah, really. Well, I've done my research a little bit, but with spore drive, can't you transport jump basically anywhere?
Yes.
Is that a time and space thing too, or just location?
Just location so far.
See, that's the thing. So far, this technology, which does not exist in Star Trek, if you could do time and space with it, if they figure that out, they can make it so that at, you know, the very end of the series, Michael Burnham does something that resets the entire universe where, you know, everything starts over from the beginning. So things, you know, evolved through time slightly differently. Maybe the Klingons evolved with hair. And Spock didn't have a sister because he doesn't have a sister. And, you know, things like that.
And she just disappears in a puff of retroactive continuity. I'm all for it.
Yeah. See, if they're able to erase that, it's fun. And then it also explains, hey, yeah, this isn't really Star Trek. That's why I didn't feel like Star Trek, because it's not Star Trek. I'd be fine with that. Also, I would have been fine with the darkness and the feel of the show, which I hate at this point, but I would have been fine with it if it was a continuation of Star Trek as opposed to going back 10 years before, instead of making it a prequel. If they made it, you know, 100 years past Voyager and things got crazy and we're at war and, you know, it's been a long war, so things are dark now, I'd probably have been okay with it.
There's, oh man, I mean, they had to work really hard to screw it up as bad as they did. But yeah. I have stuck with it. The second half of the season one premieres tonight with an episode that I think is directed by Jonathan Frakes. So I'll watch it. I mean,
oh yeah, that's right. The premiere is tonight. Is this a second episode directed by Jonathan Frakes?
I think it's the first.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if the one that he directed already... Because I know he directed one a while ago, or was set to direct one. I didn't know if it aired or not.
Yeah, I think that's the one that airs tonight.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll see. Maybe Jonathan Frakes could save it, but that's really up to the writers.
No, there's no saving it.
Yeah.
Not in a single episode. Yeah. And I don't think he wrote it.
And it's sad. Well, yeah, I'm sure he did. But what's sad about it is I know that they've done some storylines that would have been like, you know, awesome Star Trek storylines that I would have loved. Like, I know there was the time loop episode.
That was a pretty good one, too.
Yeah, well, that it's hard to, you know, do a storyline like that that people aren't going to like a little bit more, because that's just part of Star Trek, part of the sci-fi universe that, you know, us sci-fi fans love time loop stuff or time travel stuff. We just attract to it. And also, I don't think it was a Michael Burnham episode.
It kind of was
good for it. Well, I think the whole thing's, I think everything's probably a Michael Burnham episode, but at least the blonde haired guy got some more screen time.
By the blonde haired guy, I think you mean Paul Stamets or Stamets. I forget how they pronounce
it. Yeah, I don't know
his
name. I don't know his name.
Paul Stamets is a real guy. He's a real mycological researcher, and he runs a business called Fungi Perfecti. And he's written a lot of very well-regarded books about psychedelic mushrooms and also medicinal mushrooms and mushroom cultivation. So he's a real guy, and they named a character after him. And he's the astromycologist who created the spore drive. And he's a real dick in the beginning of the thing. But then he interacts with these spores in such a way that they imply that he's always on a mushroom trip, and he gets really lovey-dovey, you know, like he's on ecstasy or something all the time. And his awareness expands, his willingness to look at things differently expands, and he gets really touchy-feely. And it was really fun for a time. And that episode, the time loop episode, was right at the height of his consciousness expanding. You know, his mushroom-induced consciousness expansion.
Well, I'm glad some character on the show is having their consciousness expand. Now, what's everyone else's excuses on the show for being dicks? Because everyone's a dick on that show.
Yeah, well, I think the captain is a dick.
Yeah,
so,
Michael Burnham's a dick, in my opinion.
Yeah, she really is.
But and if she's the star, that's just... that's what didn't help me. I was like, okay, she's the star. First off, the crew should be the star, not, you know, it should be a little bit more... crew related as opposed to one person's story. But I'm like, well, she's a dick. I don't want to follow her. She did mutiny. I don't know how to put mutiny into a sentence, but she did mutiny.
She mutinied.
She mutinied. There you go.
Yep. I like Sonequa Martin-Green just fine. And I think she was good on The Walking Dead. I had no.
Oh yeah. I love her as an actress. Yeah. I love her as an actress. It's the actual character that I don't like.
Exactly. But hey, we're talking about stuff we don't like. We really like the Orville. I really like the Orville. I know you do as well.
Oh, yeah. I love the Orville. It's for someone, a big, Star Trek fan, it's going to satisfy your Star Trek craving that you've been missing all this time. More than Star Trek Discovery is going to do. Star Trek Discovery is going to be more of that Battlestar Galactica feel.
Yeah. With Star Trek Discovery and the Orville, there was this split between critics and audiences. Critics just fell all over themselves to lavish praise on Discovery and completely dismissed the Orville.
It's not even that they dismissed it as much as they seemed to be falling over themselves to see who can hate it more.
Yeah.
And it was and I understand if they didn't like it. That's fine. People have, you don't have to like everything. I understand not liking it, but trying to hate on it as hard as they did just seemed inappropriate, especially with how much fans love the Orville and don't love Discovery as much, even though they're supposed to be getting the same audience, which is really weird. So it just seemed inappropriate. I think on Rotten Tomatoes, which isn't that great of a site apparently, critics give the Orville a 20% rating and fans give it a 90% rating. And then it's the reverse. Well, not quite the reverse, but the reverse on Discovery, where it's got high critics ratings, but the fans don't care for it.
But, when Fox was advertising the Orville over this past summer, before it ever aired, they took every single joke from the pilot episode and mashed them all together into like a 90-second trailer, which made it look like it was going to be this gag-a-minute, just laugh-packed send-up of Star Trek, and it's not at all.
Yeah, not at all. Yeah, and that is part of the problem. Is Fox, and they did this for the longest time, too, at least for the first half of the season. They made it sound like it was going to be Family Guy in space. And the pilot episode is probably the closest thing to that, even though it's so much more than that. And maybe the fact that the show had a little bit more of a heart to it is what made the critics say, hey, this isn't Family Guy in space. I was prepared to hate it because, I wouldn't like Family Guy because I'm a critic. And maybe they were just too confused. They're like, hey, this isn't what it was supposed to be, but also I'm not able to see past that. And so they just hated on it. I think a lot of them probably wrote their reviews of the Orville pilot before they even watched it.
Yeah, I think so too. Or at least, they formed their opinions at their parties and whatnot, and they were not prepared to revisit those opinions.
Yeah, and it's amazing with the Orville, the second episode, Command Performance, which of course was recorded a long time after, because pilots are always done a lot earlier than the other episodes are. It's in the very next episode that you realize, whoa, this show has a lot of heart to it, and are actually is a little bit more, you know, Star Trek, relatable to Star Trek than it is to Family Guy. You know, a lot less jokes, an actual character has a story arc. They actually pay homage to Twilight Zone when Captain Mercer and Kelly are put into that human zoo.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just showed a lot of layers. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute. And I think the fans were like, wait a minute, this is a lot more than what we thought it was going to be. And that's right then is when the fans, you know, started coming in droves, which is a huge success for the show, or any show, really.
You know, the character of Bordas, when I first saw him, I just thought, okay, you know, Worf ripoff, whatever. Mm-hmm. And with that second episode, Command Performance, where we get to see Bordas naked, sitting on his egg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's when I realized, okay, this is not just, you know, off-brand Klingon. This is going to be funny and really satisfying.
The thing is, besides having a little bit of that Klingon-esque look to him and being very stern and, you know, no nonsense, really, that's it. That's all Bordas has in common with Klingons. Klingons are a warrior race. I don't see the Moklans, or at least Bordas, as being a warrior as much as just like a very serious person.
What we learned in the trailers and in that first episode, that all Moklans are male.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's going to have a certain effect on the species, and it's going to give them sort of a Klingon-like vibe, you know. And when we go to their planet, we see that they don't care about the environment at all. You know, it's all just totally trashed. But then we learn that all Moklans are male, because any that are born female get their gender reassigned immediately after birth.
Yeah, Moklans are, at least naturally, are mostly male. I mean, I'm sure more males are born, but they do have females within. But of course, they, you know, they sweep that under the rug, and they, you know, they put them through a sexual transformation at you know, when they're first born, and kind of erase the fact that they were ever female. What I think is very interesting about the Moklan race is that they are chauvinistic pigs, right? And they are all gay.
By definition. I mean, they have
to be. What's funny, though, with comments from, you know, people that watch my show, and if I'm talking about that, I get a lot of people saying, Star Trek Discovery has gay characters. Oh, social justice warriors, blah, 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 blah. I'm so glad the Orville doesn't do that stuff. I'm like, you do realize that Bordas is gay, right? Bordas and Clyden are gay. So, they're not gay. They, all their race is males. I'm like, yeah, they put penises or whatever they got in their mouth and they like it. That's gay. No matter if you have a choice or not, that's gay. So it's just funny that the Orville is able to do, you know, social issues like that, but people don't notice it as much.
Well, not only are Moklans all gay, but Bordas's partner is trans.
Yeah, it's trans, and people aren't mentioning that. I'm like, it's good that they're not mentioning it, because I think the best way is, with these issues, is to normalize it and not say, hey, we have a trans character. Just have a trans character and don't talk about it. Let them just be people. And and people aren't going to notice it as much, because they should notice it. But when you try to, you know, wear something as a badge of honor, as you champion it, people are going to backlash against it because of the heavy handedness. So I think it's funny that people will complain about something with Star Trek Discovery. And I'm like, you know, the Orville does that too, right?
But better.
Yeah, they just do it better.
You know, one of the gags that didn't make it into the trailer, because it wasn't a one-liner, but one of my favorite moments from the pilot episode. So it takes a little setup. When the captain is first meeting his senior staff, and he meets the helmsman, what's his name? Is John?
John Lamar?
John Lamar, right. And so the first thing John Lamar asks his new captain is, hey, our previous captain let us have drinks on the bridge. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things. That's when I first realized, hey, this takes place in the 25th century. It's a Star Trek style world, but people are still people. People are normal people. And I think that's something that Star Trek never got right.
Right.
As much as I love Star Trek, everyone was the perfect version of humanity. Everyone was like, oh, I love being smart. And my main goal is to just learn everything and be the best person I can be. And, you know, it becomes unrealistic. People still, you know, I bet you the Orville has more bathrooms on it than the Enterprise does, because people need to go to the bathroom once in a while.
Well, they make a point of telling us that the Orville is not the Enterprise. This is not the flagship of this group. You know, this is a mid-size, run-of-the-mill, just, you know, people doing their jobs ship.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Not the prize of the fleet. So that joke about, you know, asking the captain, here you are meeting your new captain for the first time. What are you going to say to make a good impression? Can we have drinks on the bridge? And then later, as the ship is pulling out for the first time, we've got the majestic music. We're getting reaction shots from everybody. John just pulls a cup up from under the console and takes a sip from the straw and puts it back down. No comment. You know, this is just a subtle payoff to a joke that they had set up earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and actually it's a meme. You can find that meme of John drinking his soda. So I use it quite often.
I loved it.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast with your host, KMO.
I want to stay with the Orville for a little bit because it makes me happy to think about the Orville. It doesn't make me so happy to think that we are not going to see another episode until 2019.
Yeah, it's now that's the most likely time it'll return, because Seth MacFarlane said that it won't be ready for the fall, just because it's an effects heavy show. So it takes a long time to produce an episode. But I'm like, well, so, you know, we could get it maybe mid-winter, but also that's also doubtful because of the holiday season. So, yeah, 2019 is the most likely return. Now, it could be very early 2019, perhaps January. But, of course, we won't know for sure for a long while. But I'm sure we'll see some promotional material start to come out at least in July, especially during Comic-Con.
Well, yeah, I think they're going to start shooting again next month. So
they're
in the pipeline.
Yeah, it's going to be. They're working on the show. They're working on it. It's going to be a while. Now, of course, we got some Disney money in the mix now. So maybe Disney will be like, "Hey, people are wanting this show. They love it. You know, we can make more money off of it. Hopefully, get some merchandising going on pretty soon." But maybe they'll throw some more money at it and get some more crew into the editing room, and perhaps we'll be able to get it a little sooner. But of course, you know, there's no way to know.
Yeah, I hear tell Disney likes money.
Yeah. Disney likes money. But to be fair, I like money too.
Yeah.
I love money.
I love having it anyway.
Yeah, they're just a lot better at getting it. The House of Mouse is built on a lot of dollar bills.
Well, hey, let's talk about comedy. Have you done stand-up or improv training, or what's your background in comedy?
Well, I've done improv training. I trained a couple years with Second City in Hollywood. They're a pretty famous improv company over the last many, many decades. Bill Murray, you know, people like that all came from Second City. Most of the original cast of Saturday Night Live came from Second City. So I did training with them. I was always kind of that, you know, the funny guy. And, you know, that would always be trying to crack wise. Doing improv with Second City taught me how to shut up unless it's fun. Unless you're going to be funny, don't say anything. So that
and how
was
do
a
you
huge
work
lesson.
That into your videos?
I just be my crazy self. When I'm writing a script, and yes, all my episodes are scripted, because I used to not script my videos, and it was a lot of editing and a lot of, you know, I'll say two words and then it cuts to the rest of the sentence, and then I'll say another word and it cuts to the, you know, it's all cutting, and it just wasn't as funny. So I script everything. And what I do when I'm writing a script is I'm not thinking, okay, I want to have it formed. I want this formation. What I do is I just write it as a stream of consciousness. My scripts would not be easy to read for anyone else. It's just me thinking out loud. And then what I do is I just have funny stuff, or hopefully funny stuff, come to mind while I'm writing. And then, you know, I'll think of, I've watched a lot of YouTube, so I'm aware of what YouTube videos are out there. So I'll have video clips pop into my head that I'll just throw notes into the script, say, okay, put a clip of this here, put a clip of that here. And really, it's just try to write something or make something that makes you laugh, because you can't control what makes other people laugh. I've had a lot of things that I've done on my show that people find hilarious, that I find hilarious, and other people get pissed off for some reason.
Well, people love to get pissed off. It's a pastime for many people.
Yeah. So part of it is with comedy is you do have to somewhat be funny. It helps if you're a little bit funny in real life. And just try not to be, you know, if you're going to do something that's hurtful, at least make sure it's really damn funny, so that the person that you might find it hurtful might laugh at it. If you don't think they'll laugh at it, you know, you might want to cut it out.
I've been doing a lot of reading about writing comedy recently, and one of the authors that I was reading, or it might have been a video I watched, but somebody said, in comedy, you have to be willing to hurt imaginary people.
Yes, yeah, that's good, yeah. I don't mind hurting imaginary people all damn day. I love it. One thing that I've always known about myself is when I'm being mean, I'm probably the funniest. My mind's just more quick and on it, but I hate being mean. So if the person's imaginary, that's fine. Go ahead.
They're a fair game.
Yeah, fair game. I hate imaginary people. Screw you guys.
Hey, that kind of reminds me of Black Mirror, in that an ongoing theme in Black Mirror is that we make a digital duplicate of somebody's personality and then we torture it forever. You know, so the Black Mirror White Christmas special, we had a couple different characters who basically got, you know, an infinitude of torture for, you know, transgressions, but not transgressions that warranted what they got. And that's an ongoing theme in Black Mirror, is disproportionate punishment. But they took that, you know, mental clone theme and fused it with a Star Trek parody just recently. And I know that you saw that.
Oh, yeah, that's USS Callister. Now, I don't watch a lot of Black Mirror, even though Black Mirror is right up my alley. I've seen a few episodes, but I just, you know, I'm just sit down. I'm like, I want to watch something funny. I don't want to watch something serious. So I usually end up watching other things. But, yeah, USS Callister was not only a great parody of original series Star Trek, and it was meant to be a parody, but it does take that idea of, not all imaginary people are imaginary if they're really feeling, you know, what's going on. So this really? Guy, Robert Daly in the show, Captain Robert Daly, when he's in his video game world, he takes DNA from his coworkers and he puts it into some, you know, futuristic program that he has. And his computer is able to make a digital copy of that person, but that person has all the same memories, emotions, and feelings of the person that he's copying. So they essentially are that person. They're just digital. And he tortures them on his virtual world.
But so, in real life, when he's interacting with their real life counterparts, he has no confidence. He has no ability to stand up for himself. You know, he's the chief operator, or the chief, or what is it? The chief technical officer of his company. He's the co-founder. Yeah. He's, you know, on paper, the co-boss at this company. Mm-hmm. But even the lowest level employees, like the receptionist, won't even make eye contact with him or give him the time of day.
Yeah, and he's basically a bullied. He's a in real life, he is a bullied nerd. He's a victim of harassment and, you know, people not respecting him. But he takes out that aggression in a horrible, morally reprehensible way. Where
yes,
it's like, because what's great about that episode, at the very beginning, you know, we're like, oh, this poor guy, we're on his side. And then by this, you know, second half of the episode, we're like, F this guy, he needs to be put away in prison. And we're on the side of these digital copies.
Yeah.
So so personally, as a viewer, it was very interesting to have my loyalties switched. You know, switch sides, which was you know, pretty fun, or, you know, a nice experience as a viewer instead of just passively watching a show.
He did sort of a reverse Jamie Lannister arc over the course of about 15 minutes. You start out with great sympathy for him, and very quickly he pisses that all away.
Yeah, well, very quickly you're like, whoa, this... And it's not like, oh, that guy's not what I thought. It's, no, he is a psychopath. He is a psychopath. You know, it's a American Psycho, basically.
Except, you know, the American Psycho, he had the confidence to enact his psychopathy on real people, whereas, you know, the inverted, nerdy psychopath is just waiting for the holodeck to come along so he can torture some, you know, some facsimiles of the people who bullied him in the real world. And, but I rewatched just the beginning of that today, or, you know, like the first third of it. Uh-huh. And I realized that, you know, the characters who are always in the game is always on.
So, yeah, they're aware of the passage of time.
Yeah, he's rarely around for them. But when he shows up, you know, they all get tense and they must all be thinking, gosh, I bet I was a total dick to him today. And I'm, you know, the real me was a dick to him, and now I'm going to pay for it.
Yeah, they're probably there going, oh, my God, I hope I wasn't mean to him today because he's going to tear me a new one. He's going to take it out on me. Now, the thing is if he just made copies of them, you know, not copies from their DNA, if he just created actual virtual people that, you know, didn't have feelings, they weren't sentient, I'd be like, fine, you know, take your aggressions out. It's like playing, you know, Grand Theft Auto 5 or something like that. But the fact that they actually have the memories and the feelings and the emotions and they're sentient just turns the whole premise on its head and makes you feel totally different. It's like, yeah, what if Holodeck characters, kind of like that episode of The Next Generation with Sherlock Holmes, where he becomes sentient.
Well, Moriarty does. Yes.
The Moriarty becomes sentient. And then, of course, they revisit that years later, which was great.
Right. Well, they convince him to, like, stop being a villain. They say, okay, we're going to shut down the program, but we're really going to put some thought into bringing you out into the real world. And he's like, okay, I'll do that. And then, like, 2 years later, they bring him back. And he's like, hey, wait a second. I was aware of the passage of time that whole time. And I know you guys haven't been working on this. So
yeah, they basically put him on a shelf. Yeah. And but to their own credit, they didn't know. They thought he was still just a program. They thought that him being sentient wasn't real. And still, we don't know. Maybe it's not real. Maybe it's just part of the programming to make him.
Well, that's the thing. You know, when you say it's okay to torture people who seem real but aren't and don't have any interior life, you can't know whether they have an interior life. You basically have to take the word of an expert who says, oh, yeah, I programmed that. I know that's not complicated enough to have emotions. That's just, you know, behavioral emulation. You can torture that guy. You know, once it gets to the point where you, the non-expert, can't tell a real person or a sentient entity from just something that just pretends to be, I think your moral obligations kick in that you have to treat that thing as if. I mean, you have to give it the benefit of the doubt. You have to treat it
absolutely.
As if it has feelings.
Absolutely. Well, you would think that if the lines were that blurry, that you as a person, you know, not being a psychopath, would change your behavior. But the fact that, you know, like, say you're playing Grand Theft Auto and you're running somebody over, you know that that's just ones and zeros. You know, they don't even know that they're getting hit. They're just, you know.
Right.
Somebody mo-capped. mo-capped them, you know, getting hit by a car or something like that. But if I didn't know that, I would probably not hit anybody that was trying to cross the road.
I just wouldn't play that game.
Yeah, that too.
Yeah. But, you know, an irony about all this is that in the real world, in this episode of Black Mirror, the CEO of the company, who is a real jerk to the main character, you know, he's imported into the game and his counterpart gets the most abuse, probably because, you know, his real world counterpart dishes out the most abuse.
Yeah.
But the actor who plays that guy is the main actor on Westworld, which is a whole show premised on, hey, we're going to build this park where you can go and be a total psychopath to things which look, feel, sound, act as if they are human. And you just have to take our word for it that they don't have any interior lives and they don't mind being beaten and raped and shot and terrified and, you know, the whole panoply of horrible behavior. So that was a neat little frisson there, a neat little crossover.
Oh yeah, with Westworld, they are sentient. At least they think they are. They are sentient robots with interior lives, or at least the memories implanted of interior, you know, of a life, and they're basically stuck in a time loop. When they're killed, which most of them are killed at some point, they just reset them. The time, you know, the storyline starts over, and they're stuck in a time loop where they die at the end.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to season two of that. Although I'm a little, I don't want to say squeamish, but it's kind of like The Walking Dead in that I think it gives a much darker portrayal of humanity than is justified. I don't think that a park where you could go and the selling point is that you can go and, you know, abuse people and murder them and, you know, do all manner of reprehensible things to them is going to be as big a seller.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would be a big seller in the fact of, you know, playing out stories and stuff like that. But as far as, you know, just going there and having, you know, you could do whatever you want to these people, you could rape them, this and that. I am sure that humanity wouldn't be up for that.
And so I compared it to The Walking Dead because I think on The Walking Dead, we get this vision of humanity of, you know, once the rules are gone, once the enforcers of public morality are gone, those institutions are gone, that people are just going to revert to the most primal, you know, Hobbesian war of all against all mode. And that's just not how humans have evolved. I mean, we are cooperative to a fault. That is how we survive in the world.
Yeah, I think there will just be, you know, most people would try to get along. And there'd always be, you know, the wild cards out there that are, you know, the crazies that, you know, the Negans that are trying to, you know, take over and be dictators. There'll always be that, I think, in that situation. But I think overall, people aren't going to be like that. You know, it might be more of a Wild West situation. Well, it definitely would be more of a Wild West situation. People are out there. They're having a very hard time of it. Things are rough. You know, people get mad. They might, you know, bring out a gun and kill each other a little bit more often than usual, and every once in a while the black hat will ride in, but otherwise people are going to be working towards things getting better as opposed to tearing it all apart.
Cooperation will be the rule of the day. It will be your everyday experience is to go and peacefully interact with other people in order to create, you know, a non-zero sum result where everybody is better off. And then, yeah, then the black hat asshole rides into town and, you know, does some things so that he will deserve what he's going to get.
Yeah.
Coming up pretty soon.
Well, the parallel is like, you know, you take a while, you know, what we think of, you know, the Wild West or that era where things were rougher, but people were more polite to each other. Maybe it's a lot like the episode of the Orville majority rule where everyone can upvote and downvote each other. And everyone in the beginning of that is super polite and overly nice to each other because they're all trying to get upvotes because downvotes, you know, and get you a lobotomy. Maybe in the Wild West, everyone was overly polite to each other because it could easily, someone could take out a gun and shoot you and, you know, there might not be justice, things like that. So maybe it's, you know, a parallel there where people are being overly nice to each other for the greater good, you know, for their own protection.
Well, that's the Robert Heinlein philosophy, that a well-armed society is a polite society because you don't want to get shot.
Yeah, exactly.
So we've talked a good long while here, and so now I can bring this up safely because it cannot now dominate the majority of the conversation. What did you think of The Last Jedi?
Ah, The Last Jedi. That's...
Yeah.
It's complicated because there was so much wrong with The Last Jedi. So much wrong with it. But it still was kind of fun, and it felt fun. I wasn't bored at any point. But the thing is, with The Last Jedi, you know, Luke, that was not Luke Skywalker. Mary Poppins, Leia, shouldn't be flying through space. You know, there's just the porgs. To hell with the porgs. I still had a good time watching it, though. And that's because over the last few decades, I have been bombarded with Star Wars trying to sell me stuff. They're trying to sell me shirts. They're trying to sell me toys, silverware, you know, special editions, this and that. There is so much more merchandising going on than actual content to watch that I stopped caring about Star Wars just because I saw them as just a corporate machine. And because I stopped liking Star Wars, I was able to enjoy Star Wars a little bit more because I didn't hold any importance to it because I realized it's just to sell toys. Which really,
Opposite boat because I religiously followed Star Wars, The Clone Wars, and Star Wars Rebels. So I've watched 10 years of Star Wars on TV where they do all this elaborate world building, and it's got so much more heart than any of the recent movies. And so to watch 10 years of really good Star Wars on TV and then come in to The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi, they just don't feel like they're in the Star Wars universe. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like they are honoring what came before at all. It just seems, you know, from my perspective, given the pressures, the financial pressures on a movie, which is supposed to do well internationally and make huge amounts of money in the opening weekend, to me, I just don't care about Star Wars movies anymore. Star Wars that I care about is on TV.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is TV. Well, first off, with Star Wars of all things, more than any other movie franchise, not only are they supposed to make a lot of money, they're supposed to make the most money ever made.
Right.
And that pressure is crazy. So what they do is they shove as much stuff as they can, you know, get into the film, whether it makes sense or not, to get people in there, you know, chewing on that popcorn. And, you know, a lot of people will go see it 3, 4, 5 times, not realizing until 2 years later that they didn't even really like it. Because Star Wars is an emotion. Star Wars isn't necessarily a makes sense on paper type of thing. It's an emotion. So they're trying to capitalize on the emotion of it. And what you're talking about with television, I think television is the better format now. You know, they're trying to shove a lot of story or a lack of story into 2 hours for a movie, or 2.5 hours for The Last Jedi. And you can't do anything. You can't tell a story anymore with that if you want it to be layered. Now, if Star Wars was, The Last Jedi was simple, where if you're doing an adventure with Rey and Luke, and they're doing their adventure together, and you're following them the whole time, and they cut out all the other stuff, you could probably make a really good movie. But they're trying to shove in so much that you can't tell a cohesive story that people are going to, connect to at all. So with television, you can tell a story and people are going to connect to it, and it's going to be emotionally more satisfying. Movies are over. We don't need them anymore.
I still go see them. We live, the village that I live in, and it's an actual village. We have a movie theater where the town, or the village is part of a larger entity called the town. The town subsidizes the movie theater. So we get first run films, and all seats, all shows are $5. And nice. The concessions, you can get a big tub of popcorn, a drink, and a package of candy for $5. So I'll go see almost anything for $5.
Well, yeah. And, well, I'd probably enjoy a lot more movies if that were the case. Yeah. Now, luckily in Tulsa, you know, we have our big fancy theaters, which, you know, have the big dollar price. But also some of the... If you're a theater that doesn't have recliners but just have nice regular movie seats, they don't charge a lot. On The Last Jedi, I paid like $4.75 to see it, but the concessions cost me $16, and that's that's just a small popcorn, a medium soda, and a candy.
I live in Vermont, but my kids live in Maryland, and I get down to see them about every 6 weeks. And when I go there, we have a ritual. I take them to Red Robin first. And then there's a nice theater in the same parking lot as Red Robin. And then we go into the theater and they understand we're not even looking at that concession counter. We're just walking right on past because, you know, we all have full bellies. We just came from the restaurant. You know, we're probably going to have to get up and take a piss in the middle of the film because we drank so much Coke. But I can get a meal for three at Red Robin, which is, you know, a pretty decent meal. And it's going to cost me less than it would cost me to get them popcorn and sodas and stuff at the movies.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's crazy. So, you know, a lot of us are vying for, well, hell, just wait an extra month and you can watch it on your own TV because movies come out pretty damn quick on the rental scene.
So one last topic, then I'll let you go. I really enjoyed the Netflix original movie Bright.
Oh, yeah, I watched that.
Critics hated it. They fell all over themselves trying to one-up each other on describing it in the most unflattering way. One critic said it was the worst movie of 2017. Another critic said it was the cinematic manifestation of a broken sewer pipe.
See, that's ridiculous, because whether or not it's a great movie or a decent movie or a bad movie, it's not that bad of a movie. They go over them. They're looking for views. The critics are looking for views. And I saw Bright. And the thing is when I go into a, when I sit down to watch a movie now, I don't expect that movie to change my life. And a lot of people do that. People sit down like, this movie is going to be the movie that makes me feel good about myself and makes me think the world's going to be a good place. It's like, no, it's a movie. And so I saw Bright and I enjoyed it. There were certain things I'm like, oh, I wish they did this, I wish they did that. But I'm like, the idea, the premise, the alternate reality of you know, people living in a world just like the world we live in today, but orcs and fairies and elves actually exist, and we've been coexisting with them for thousands of years. And, you know, that whole idea, I guess they expected, you know, all of a sudden, Will Smith to end up in Mordor or something at the end. Like, no, this is a small story, a small little thing that's happening to these two characters on their shift as police officers, and you know, they have their different stories. I thought it was a great movie, but it wasn't like the most amazing movie. But not all movies are supposed to be the most amazing movies. Right. We expect too much, I think.
Well, the part of Bright was showing us just another view of racism. It's like, look, we got Asian, Hispanic, Black, White characters all united in their hatred of orcs.
Yeah.
And
orcs and orcs.
Go ahead.
Well, I know what you were going to say is the critics were, you know, probably not happy about the heavy-handedness. And, you know, you could argue that, you know, because the orcs, let's just face it, the movie's like, orcs are Black people. Orcs are Black people in the hood in this movie. And so they went out of their way to, you know, have the orcs wearing, you know, gang colors and do-rags and spray paint and all that stuff, because they're trying to copy, you know, Inglewood, Los Angeles. But what would the orcs' lives be like in Vermont, per se, you know, in a different city where things aren't
all... We probably wouldn't have any orcs here.
There you go. See, there'd be more elves.
There'd be a lot of elves who own vacation homes in Vermont. I think most of them would probably be commuting from Boston and New York City. First of all, Vermont, I think, is the whitest state. So we have very few people here who are not just lily white.
Yeah.
And Vermont has a huge percentage of homes which are vacant most of the time, because these are expensive vacation homes owned by rich people who live elsewhere.
So
I think we'd have a lot of people who make their living as caretakers for luxurious homes owned by elves, and they almost never see their elven employers. And maybe there'd be a few people up in Burlington, but in my neck of Vermont there would be no orcs.
Well, that'd be an interesting movie too, because they are making Bright too, the new
I can't wait.
Release.
Heard that they're thinking about making a series out of that episode of Black Mirror called the USS Callister.
Yeah, they're thinking about it. There's
I heard
nothing
that from
officially
you,
yet.
Actually.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, I heard it in an article that I read. But with an interview with the guy who directed it. They're thinking about the possibility of doing a full series. Of course, it won't be the classic Star Trek series, because that was just part of the original storyline. They eventually, in the end of the episode, ended up in a more of a modern, you know, sci-fi space adventure type
kind of a EVE
scenario.
Online or Mass Effect looking thing.
Yeah, and that would actually be it would be amazing to see this crew of sentient people that are actually digital NPCs, you know, living inside of a video game world. So they could put a lot of video game tropes in there. And also they'd actually be interacting with real people playing the video game in the real world. So that'd be interesting.
All right. I'm going to drive my Echo Dot crazy here, because I'm going to say a particular name several times, and then what I say after that isn't going to make sense to it. But I bought myself an Echo Dot, because I think it's going to be a great window through which to watch the evolution of artificial intelligence, because the Dot doesn't do anything except listen for, you know, the wake word, which is her name. So it's not a sophisticated thing. Most of what it's doing off in the cloud somewhere.
And yeah, so, it's Siri is all it is.
Right. So Amazon's going to be able to continuously improve the capabilities of this AI. Mm-hmm. And our home devices are going to improve. They're going to reflect that improvement, even though we're not actually upgrading the device. So we're going to get to see the, you know, just in the increasingly complex behavior that she's capable of, you know, the evolution of artificial intelligence without having to spend a lot of money to always be getting new gear. You know, the smart speaker is just our window into how good AI is getting. And I was thinking about with this USS Callister crew, you know, these are digital people, but based on real people. But as they're going into the future, they're not going to get to see how the real world is changing, but they're going to see a reflection of it in, you know, the behavior of the human players in the game world.
Mm-hmm.
And that would probably be a fun ongoing premise for a series, I think.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And these are people with memories of the real world. So
right. There's
probably gonna be that side of them that's always trying to make contact. You know, the undiscovered country for them is the outside world. They're trying to get back to it. And they'll, you know, who knows what will happen. Maybe they'll be able to get uploaded into, you know, a standalone computer in the real world with a camera. You know, they could see what's going on. Or maybe, you know, they're playing, you know, they run into a player who, you know, has his webcam. And, you know, maybe his webcam can, you know, come up and they could see into the real world.
JP, I have really enjoyed our conversation, and I will continue to enjoy all of the things that you're uploading to YouTube. So thanks so much for talking to me.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Been a lot of fun.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Good on ya.
Alrighty, that was JP. Again, his YouTube channel is called Egotastic Funtime, and his show that we were talking about is called Talking the Orville. There's a link to it in the show notes for this episode on crealm.com. So if you want more of what you heard in this conversation, if you like JP's vibe, you like the way you felt listening to this conversation, well, there's more to be had at his YouTube channel. So do go and check it out. And wow, there's so much good TV right now. And, you know, it's not technically speaking TV, I suppose, or I guess it is. I mean, it's television. It's a vision at a distance. But last night, I watched the first episode of the new Amazon show, Philip K. Dick's Electric Dreams. And it didn't blow me away in terms of the writing, but the caliber of the acting that they're getting and the production value really has me thinking that this is going to be something to watch. Really excited about it. And also, there's a sci-fi novel that I read many years ago called Altered Carbon, which has been made into a Netflix series. And that looks really excellent. So, wow. What a time. What a time to be watching TV as the world outside our windows disintegrates, crumbles, and, well, you know, crumbling and disintegration is the prelude to renewal and new growth. And if, from your point of view, that is a saccharine sentiment, an overly optimistic way of looking at things, well, if what you want is confirmation of your belief that everything is going to hell, well, there's plenty of it to be found on this glorious web of ours. Whatever viewpoint you want to have validated, there's somebody out there to validate it for you. I'm not so interested in feeding the doomers anymore. But if you're displeased with the pop culture-y nature of this episode of the podcast and the lack of serious content, well, fear not. I will be talking with Charles Hugh Smith very soon about his new book, Money and Work Unchained. Ostensibly, it's a book about UBI, or Universal Basic Income, but the bits that I have read so far are not really about UBI, they're just about what we mean when we talk about work. What is work? It's more than just what you do to earn money. And therefore, just giving people money when they are out of work doesn't replace what the work gave them. So I'll be talking to Charles Hugh Smith about that pretty soon, and that will either be a radio show or an episode of this, the Free Sea Realm podcast. And the content of upcoming Sea Realm Vault podcasts will be determined by those Sea Realm Vault listeners who write to me and basically express their opinions and their desires.
If you want to write to me, you can do so. My email address is kmo@crealm.com. That's the letter C and then a dash and then R-E-A-L-M, crealm.com. There's also the Friends of the Sea Realm group on Facebook, where you can not only communicate with me, but other listeners to the Sea Realm podcast. I know I won't hear from most of you, and that's okay. You have things to do, I have things to do. None of us really need to get lost in social media, not any more than we already are. So, to those of you out in the silent majority from whom I will never hear, thanks for listening, thanks for taking an interest, and until you next hear my voice, please, stay well.